Our third case for this morning is Williams v. Colvin. Mr. Forbes.
May it please the court, my name is Randall Forbes. I represent the appellant who is the father of a deceased claimant before Social Security Administration.
If he prevails, the father prevails, does he get the benefits that she would have gotten from 2002 to 2008?
Yes, if it's paid under the disability insurance benefit or Title II.
Come on, give me a straight answer. Does he get what she would have gotten for those 6 years?
Yes.
Well, you're saying that her disability benefits. He doesn't get SSI, right?
That was about what I was going to make as a distinction. Yes.
Right. Well, that's less.
But that's all that's available to him.
Yes,
under
I
the
know.
Law.
I'm just curious. Yeah. What is it? So, what fraction of the total is it?
I do not know the answer, Your Honor. I did not do that calculation.
Okay.
May I proceed?
Certainly.
Okay. There are plenty of things to focus on, but I'm going to just focus initially on the lay witness testimony. The district court seemed to think that it was redundant and therefore did not need to be considered in the kind of substantive and detailed way that the prior district court implicitly held, if not explicitly, and at least...
second hearing or whatever it was.
Yes.
Why didn't Williams and his daughter attend?
That would have been the third hearing.
Well, whatever it was. Before
they
were
present. I did not have them testify because I don't want my clients deposed for a third time on the same issues, and they'd already.
But the new ALJ hadn't seen her, right?
She was under a duty to read the prior testimony.
Well, but wouldn't you expect the new judge to want to question the applicant?
Your Honor, I had strategic reasons for doing what I did.
Yeah, it sounded really bad reasons.
No,
really
they were not, though.
I don't get it.
Here's my point on a lay witness testimony, if I could make it, please. And that is this. There are some areas of lay witness testimony that could never be redundant. For example, observing an epileptic.
Could never be what?
Redundant.
What does it matter whether it's a redundant? The point is you've got a new judge. The new judge has been told to do over this this application. So doesn't she want to see the applicant? I don't get it.
Your Honor, they were putting my client through the same set of questions for the
so
third
what?
Time.
She's asking for money from a new judge. And she doesn't want to what? She doesn't want to spend a half hour or something answering some questions?
Any additional inconsistencies would have been used against her. And that
quite properly.
Right. And they already covered that area.
Because you say she might have said something different. So apparently
it
wasn't fully covered.
I didn't need her to say anything different.
It wasn't fully covered by your own statement. I think it's a very serious mistake not to have her testify.
I understand. I understand
No, you're stuck
that it
with
could
it
be
at this point, so maybe you can make your
okay.
other
Here's
arguments.
The point. The lay witness testimony cannot be redundant in these circumstances.
Well, you're saying it's an outside observer as opposed to her interior experience.
Right.
And the outside observer brings something different.
That's exactly right. Because the observer may have abilities that the impaired person does not. And to the extent the case law in this circuit has not carved out an exception for The observers of epileptics, the observers of who have mental health episodes, or even the observers of cognitively impaired persons. The cognitively impaired person may get it right, but the non-cognitively impaired observer, it is important to hear from them in that relation.
Okay.
But the problem of her application, as I see it, is that some of the symptoms that she claims to have don't have a solid medical basis. I don't regard that as critical. There are many bad medical conditions people have that the medical profession cannot explain, can't assign a cause to. But then it's critical that the administrative law judge believe what the applicant is saying. If the applicant says, you know, I have these terrible pains, I fall down, this and that, the ALJ responds, well, yes, fibromyalgia doesn't create those symptoms, and so on and so forth. That doesn't matter. If the ALJ believes that the applicant has these very serious problems which prevent her from working full time, that's all the applicant needs to get the benefits. But if the applicant isn't there to testify, what is the ALJ supposed to do?
In this particular case, Your Honor, I mean, I've got lots of experience doing these cases. I have over 100 cases with this particular judge. I made the right strategic decision. I also knew my client.
So there was other medical evidence in the record that you thought the ALJ should have dealt with.
Yeah.
And if you want to save some rebuttal time, that's up to you. But it's
thank you. I'll answer your question.
Yeah, there are plenty of other records. So if you could review that. I mean, the other question is whether the ALJ took account of all of that evidence.
Yeah. At this point, I think the ALJ's most egregious error is she did not consider the mental health evidence between the date of the rape and the time they got the sleepwalking night terror thing somewhat resolved. That occurred almost entirely before this ALJ even engages the analysis. On the other issues, they're very important. And I could make
According to the ALJ, the major condition that she complained about, the terrible sleep problems she had, smoking while asleep, so really terrible stuff, that got under control with medication. That was all right. Later, she has these really terrible problems of falling, but she's pronounced disabled when that happens. So the problem I see in your case, what is the evidence that once her sleep problems were under control and before she started the falling down, nevertheless, she was disabled?
And my response would be, during the interim period you're suggesting, that's difficult evidentially. But it's not difficult evidentially for us from the rape until the end of the...
Would you answer my question? That's a critical period, right, isn't it?
So is the prior period, which is way over 12 months. Which is our strong...
So that's your backup argument, that
yeah.
there was
a
more than 12-month period.
Yeah. My response to that period, Your Honor, is that there were diagnoses of fibromyalgia and pain disorders during that period, and she was treated with very serious pain medications. And that evidence, actually, I think is strong.
Well, if the medications work, then where's the disability?
I don't think they were working, Your Honor. I don't think the evidence really supports that they work. I think the evidence supports a waxing and waning, which would not have been sufficient for her to work. So.
Okay, you can save the rest of your time if you like. Mr. Adili.
May it please the court, counsel, Gavin Adili on behalf of the commissioner. In this case, the claimant had to demonstrate that she was
disabled. Why didn't the ALJ say she wanted to see this person?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Well, I think it's irresponsible. How can she make a decision depends to maybe critical extent on the credibility of the applicant?
I think that this is absolutely
true. How do you judge the credibility of the applicant without the applicant?
Well, actually, the ALJ made clear that the applicant's testimony in 2007, and in fact, by extension, her father's testimony at the same time, was what really was critically negative for her application. Because at that time, at the second hearing, both the claimant and her father testified that she had been somnambulating, sleepwalking, for the whole period, from 2002 to 2007. Her father, in fact, testified that she sleepwalked every night during that period. And when you go back and look at the record, it sort of completely undermines that. She initially reported it in 2002, but reported by the end of 2002 on medication that she was resting much better at night and much more aware of what she was doing. In 2004, a note suggests a spike, but in sleepwalking reports, but a reduction in her Dalmain prescription resolved the issue. And by 2006 and 2007, toward the end of sort of the disputed period in which she had to be found disabled in order to get disability insurance benefits, she's reporting feeling quite well in terms of the titration of her medication.
Well, your opponent said there was a 12-month period in which she...
Well, he alleges, he makes the argument in his brief that should the court find that by the end of the disputed period in June 2006, her DLI, she was no longer disabled, it should at least find that she was disabled at some point for some 12-month period.
Right, that's on page 23 of his brief. He says that the record shows that there's at least this 12-month, closed period of...
That's correct, Your Honor. But when you look at the records, it was reasonable for the ALJ, in light of her evaluation of the medical evidence, to conclude that the claimant's allegations about the severity of those impairments were not credible. Her allegations were not credible.
But that's where the father's testimony can come in. Yeah. So he's quite specific about the period. He says a strong argument can be made supporting a period starting in September of 2002, the date of the last rape, up till June 1, 2004, when the Dalmain prescription is adjusted. And even though she says she's feeling better, somebody on the outside is saying, well, maybe you're feeling better, but you're still screaming at night.
Right, except that she was no longer reporting it, right?
Well, how would she report it if it's her father listening to her?
Well, presumably because the only way that she could report it, so to the extent that she ever reported it, was from a third party reporting it to her, and she's living at her parents' house. So
but
presumably
but
her father is always reporting to her when she's sleepwalking.
Well, I think you're sliding over some things because her perception of how well she's sleeping may not match up well with what her father is. So you're essentially saying you prefer this hearsay testimony from her, my father told me I was screaming again at night, to the father just testifying, here's waxes and wanes, sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better.
It's not so much that I would say that I prefer it, Your Honor. I just think it's of a piece. It's of the same line of evidence. I understand opposing counsel's argument, and apparently Your Honor lends it some credence, that it's slightly different because he's observing her when she is herself not conscious.
I mean, frankly, I'm just thinking, raising kids, they have nightmares in the middle of the night. They don't necessarily remember, what happened.
Sure, but the record makes clear that she, when she was sleepwalking, she would wake up. She would become conscious somewhere different from where she went to sleep.
But some sleepwalkers don't have any memory of that in the morning.
But I think if you look at the record here, it appears that she did, that she expressed sort of being disconcerted at finding herself somewhere sort of different at the end of her sleepwalking episodes, at least sometimes. And so I think it's difficult to completely distinguish those lines of testimony, and to the degree that the ALJ gave good reasons for discounting her the claimant's.
But this ALJ seems to emphasize the lack of some medical basis for her complaints.
Yes. So,
but as I was saying to your opponent, there are lots of bad medical experiences that people have that the profession can't explain.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So but shouldn't the ALJ have called her and her father and see whether she, the ALJ, believed these people?
Well, I'm not sure that the ALJ could have forced her to testify. I can't remember from the transcript.
Well, if she said she wanted to hear them and the lawyer refused, that would be, I would certainly think she should throw the case out.
No, that would be quite damning, Your Honor. But with respect to your statement about the etiology of some of the impairments, what the ALJ was doing in 2011 and 2012 with kind of a difficult record was, as Your Honor said earlier, sort of coming to it fresh and trying to figure out what was going on during
the
period.
She made a difficult record by not summoning Williams and Townsend.
Well, both of them were present at the hearing, but neither testified. And as counsel,
they were actually present.
Yes, the record shows that they were.
So,
present.
So the ALJ could just have said, you know, I'd like to hear from you.
No, I certainly suppose the ALJ.
So we're doing very easy, and we don't have explanations from the ALJ about the panic attacks and the depression and the sleep disorder and how often they happen. You don't have to be absent too many days a month before vocational experts say you're not employable.
Three times
a month is usually considered enough.
That's true, Your Honor, but I think what's crucial when looking at that passage is that the ALJ made clear that she didn't find claimant to be fully credible, and then the only real medical opinion
on
the record.
How can she find the applicant not fully credible?
By identifying material inconsistencies between her testimony and the record, and then also citing other doctors' sort of notes, like, for example, the note by Dr. Babcock, who indicated a concern that she was, you know, in his Medicaid evaluation, that she was just concerned with maintaining her Medicaid eligibility, something that was also noted by another doctor in the record at transcript 619, and noting, for example, the fact that Dr. Rao had asked her to get more testing to identify further the etiology of her impairments, and that she had declined to do so. So there are multiple instances.
But
in
here,
the,
too, you know, you could ask, why didn't she do so? Some people don't because they don't have the money. You know, other people don't maybe just because they don't want to be poked anymore. You know, I don't know.
Sure, Your Honor. But in this case, I don't think money certainly is an issue because she was on Medicaid since 2002. And I think to the extent that she required testing in order to ascertain the nature of her impairment, there's no indication she could have gotten it.
I'm looking at page 5 of her opinion. At the top, she says, Dr. Barakashvili assessed a GAF of 45, indicating serious problems, but this rating took into account the claimant's physical problems with chronic pain and loss of function and her frustration with needing to be financially dependent on her parents. I don't get the but.
I mean, the only thing that I would say with respect to that, Your Honor, is that her frustration with needing to be financially dependent on her parents is not.
But the but is, you know, why does, if it's a GAF of 45, what's wrong with taking into account the physical problems with chronic pain and loss of function?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
I don't think it's proper. I think that the frustration is perfectly right. This person has had serious mental problems, and frustration could be, of course, a contributor for a person like this who's psychiatrically extremely fragile.
It could, Your Honor, although I think that Your Honor may look at this record and lend more credence to the claimant's credibility than the ALJ did. I think it was reasonable on this
credence
record.
Credence to the... I don't get it. If she has doubts about the person's credibility, why isn't she ask him? He's sitting there.
I understand, Your Honor. I mean, I can't rectify that now.
Well, I think it's inexcusable, I must say. I think it's irresponsible for a government agency to behave in this way.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but...
Well, if it's irresponsible, there ought to be a do-over.
Well, first of all, Your Honor,
you say perhaps. Maybe you think it's responsible. Sure,
I don't know
wants to listen to these people.
The ALJ tried to do everything that was reasonable.
No, because she didn't ask these people, the father and the daughter, to testify.
It's
unreasonable because the people are sitting there. I didn't realize they were at the hearing.
They were present at the hearing. That's correct. I'm not sure she could have forced them to do so.
Of course not, but if they refuse, that's a good ground for throwing out her case.
But I think it's equally fine for her to take the...
No, it's not equally fine. How can it be equally fine to go rummaging through these past records and try to figure out who's saying what the condition of this person is?
Well, I would submit that it's because she concluded that the 2007 testimony drastically undermined the claimant's credibility and that it was enough for her to decide the case. Obviously,
what drastically undermined?
The fact that at that point, claimant and her father were still saying that she had been sleepwalking every night during the disputed period, the five-year period from her alleged onset date in May 2002 through her DLI of June 2006.
But she didn't say that in this opinion.
Pardon?
She didn't say that. Where did she say that they lied when they said she was sleepwalking every night?
Well, I mean, she
well,
says...
Well, where did they say that?
I'm about to quote a passage. As noted by the district court,
where
the claimant,
are you?
It's page 4 of 11. The claimant did complain of sleepwalking panic symptoms, and at the claimant's first hearing, her father testified about their occurrence.
Now, which paragraph are you?
I apologize. It is the middle of the third paragraph following bullet
paragraph.
Heading 3.
All right.
Oh, I see. No. Okay. It's about
however, the record shows that a few weeks after taking Prozac and Seroquel in 2002, the claimant reported resting much better at night and being aware of what she was doing at night, and so forth and so on. And it marshals sort of the parts of the record of the ALJ.
Where does she say she was lying?
It does not say that.
Well, and what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the clear inference that can be drawn from what was
you
said.
You said that the latest ALJ, found that she had given this false testimony about sleepwalking every night when actually she was doing much better. Now, where is it that this ALJ says that?
I apologize, Your Honor. I must have overstated the case, but the clear inference from the language
that is
present...
You don't really overstate it. You stated falsely...
Well, it was not my intention.
...that she had made a credibility determination about this sleepwalking.
I don't think that it is false. I think that's the clear inference from this passage.
I don't see a clear inference. She doesn't say anything. I don't get it. What a clear inference. She's lying. They think she thinks she's sleepwalking every night. She's a confused person. Who knows what she knows? Maybe she is sleepwalking every night, but it's not as bad. You know, sleepwalks for 5 minutes or something. And she doesn't smoke cigarettes while she's sleepwalking.
I don't think there's anything to support that in the record, Your Honor, but I have...
Support
I have no
what?
That maybe she... It's
well, how about a comment from the ALJ on this, right? Rather than leaving us in a complete puzzlement over what the ALJ actually thought about her credibility?
I think that this passage gives us enough to ascertain the ALJ's mind. We can draw the clear inferences from what the ALJ did say, but beyond that, I don't have response to that, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dealey. Anything further, Mr. Forbes?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.